While we're still talking about the advisory bodies, it might be useful to have your take on the global strategy of 1994, which actually started as a cultural framework and then got kind of picked up and considered to be both cultural and natural over time. I guess it's the question of the usefulness of the global strategy and the role that the advisory bodies, particularly the cultural ones, played in building that, and how effective you think that is.
Well, I think just to begin in a very general way, I think the global strategy was a very important innovative step forward. And when it was first articulated, perhaps in 1994, when there was a meeting which gave us the bones or the skeleton of a global strategy, I think that was that offered a major departure for the committee from previous ways of looking at heritage and perhaps even dealing with heritage. I don't think all of the opportunities that were put on the table by that meeting in 1994 have been realized. But nevertheless, there have been many benefits that have flowed out of taking, perhaps misinterpreting some of the push that that meeting came up with. And those benefits have had to do with mobilization of the different regions and managers and administrators and national authorities in the different regions around World Heritage issues. In the end, I think the global strategy, if you're going to assess it in terms of the numbers and the statistics, you know, has it resulted in a more balanced and more representative World Heritage List because suddenly we're more aware? I think the answer is probably it didn't make any difference at all. But to go back to the beginning, I think one of the important things that the Global Strategy meeting offered, which has not really been picked up on as it might have been, is the move from a typology-focused list to a thematically-focused list. I think the results of the global strategy and the sort of little scheme of, you know, broad themes it proposed offered a big opportunity to move beyond, you know, the way the committee had been working for quite a period of time. The global strategy was preceded in my memory by efforts to define a global study, to carry out a global study, which was, I think, a kind of misguided effort on the part of the committee and on the part of the advisory bodies who weren't sure quite of what they were trying to get at. But the global study was meant to establish a kind of geocultural template into which you could pop all the possible World Heritage nominations. If you could have a matrix that was big enough and comprehensive enough on the wall, then you could just take every new nomination and say, ah, we don't have any of those, and we'd know right away what the answer should be. The problem with the early versions of the global study, and Henry Clear provided a couple of drafts, but other people were involved as well, is that they were highly Eurocentric, and they were perceived to be highly Eurocentric. The other thing that was missing is that implicitly this involved a focus on categories of heritage as opposed to thematic typologies into which heritage properties might fit. What do I mean by that? I meant that people looked at the question of new nominations in terms of how many of this type do we have? So if we had a new French cathedral coming along, a new nomination, we'd ask, well, how many of these French cathedrals do we already have? We have six. Do we need more? Do we need seven? And, you know, that's a superficial question, but that's where it would start. And then you'd say, okay, what are the qualities of the seven that might allow us to distinguish it from the first six? And if we're going to talk about outstanding universal value, can we actually make the claim that this has a different kind of outstanding universal value than something that's already there on the list? And the global study somehow accepted the idea that typologies were okay. Somehow those of us working with typologies were always dissatisfied with this discussion. You know, in reality, the answer to the question, how many French cathedrals is enough? There is no answer to that. You can't, there's no clear, objective, mathematical answer to that. And it's the wrong kind of question to ask. It's not a question of understanding what the typology should be and then asking what's the right number. It's a question really of backing up and recognizing what those typologies really express in terms of development on the planet. And the thematic framework offers an opportunity to say, what are the basic messages? What are the basic themes? What are the basic stories of human development on this planet that are important? you know, and to parse that question down into sub-themes and so on. And then looking at particular nominations that come forward and say, how well do those sites or those places support this theme? And once you work in a thematic framework, you're much more likely to come up with a range of inscriptions which encompass all of the major ways in which, you know, society has organized itself to produce conditions for living and development over time in the world. And it's a much more sophisticated way of looking at heritage. I suspect the Canadians and the Australians who were part of the 1994 meeting had a lot to do with this because they both are quite comfortable with this back home. So it may have edged onto the table with a little bit of help from some delegations. But I really think it offered a huge opportunity to, you know, change the way of thinking. And the committee adopted the report, you know, of the 1994 Global Strategy Meeting. And therefore, in my mind, it adopted that thematic framework, that very schematic, short little thematic framework. I don't think the committee as a whole really understood the difference. I think they saw this was a better way to go forward than what it did, what it, you know, had followed, which was the global study, you know, the effort to find a comprehensive, you know, matrix within which you could plant all civilizations and all forms of expression of those civilizations. They saw this as simplifying, clarifying, and energizing. But I think if they'd actually asked themselves, what are, you know, can we look at these themes? Can we look at them more closely? Can we elaborate on these in more detail and come up with something like Parse Canada's system plan, for example, but for the planet? Then I think it would have changed the way nominations come forward. I think it would have helped countries better understand what OUV is all about, because they could see, if they can see their place in the place of their site in aiding the expression of one of those important themes, then the link to OUV is quite clear. That didn't happen. And in some ways, it's just led to more confusion from time to time. I mean, ICOMOS did a big gap study at the request of the committee, which took them 3 or 4 years in the middle 2000s, 2003 to 2006 or something like that. They were involved with this. And their study talks about three different ways of assessing what's on the list. They refer to typologies, and they analyze everything in terms of typologies. They refer to themes. That's good, because it goes back to 1994. They also refer to chronology, as I remember, as another way of classifying sites. But they didn't, you know, ICOMOS didn't get it. You know, when you look closely at the theme part, which is the part that interested me most, when they came to sub-themes, the sub-themes were all the typologies. So they had, you know, they mixed up the apples and the oranges. And so their document really didn't offer any clarity or guidance, I think, to the committee. It sort of reflected the existing situation, but it didn't say, here's the way to go forward in it, because they didn't themselves really see what advantages a thematic approach might have offered. The big advantage of the global strategy, I think, has been, however, as I said at the very beginning, the idea that the World Heritage Center, with funds from the committee, funds from any source, would go out region by region and on a regular, repeating basis, engage the authorities and the site managers in workshops, asking them just, you could call these training workshops or awareness building workshops, but asking them to think more clearly about what OUV might be like in a region. You know, what does OUV mean for you? What does authenticity mean? This might be very didactic. It's sort of going back to the core ideas inside the convention. For some, it might have been repetitive, but by putting people together to compare notes, you know, within a cultural group or within a cultural context, it really opened the door to recognizing cultural specificities in a region. It allowed states parties in to say, well, that part of it's for us. You know, we link to that. So it would either confirm or give them confidence in the directions they were going in or open up new doors for them. So they'd go back home with some new energy and some new thinking. They'd go back home also as part of a kind of World Heritage Network. The World Heritage Center, who organized most of these workshops, would return on a fairly frequent basis, region by region. So there came to be a kind of expectation that, you know, World Heritage is not just we alone with our sites in a country, or, you know, myself alone as a manager, but, you know, you're part of something bigger. So it really energized many countries to think more about their sites and to think more about what they represented, maybe to extend that perhaps into thinking about how, now that we understand our sites and their OUV, can we better manage them? That's been very positive, and it's still there. You know, there's still every year a continuing round of these kinds of workshops.